Today's Tay Show will be on case 37 in the Mumon Khan. Case 37 is entitled Joshu's Oak Tree. A monk asked Joshu, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to China? Joshu said, the oak tree in the garden. Mumon's comment, if you understand Joshu's answer intimately, there is no Shakyamuni before you, no Maitreya to come. Mumon's verse, words cannot express things, speech does not convey the spirit. Swayed by words, one is lost, blocked by phrases, one is bewildered. I want to thank everybody for doing such an excellent job this morning. People were sitting so still for a long time, long, deep sitting. It's really wonderful to see. Thank you so much for making such an excellent effort. This is a very important koan, and one that can take people a long time to work through. So first of all, it's not actually the oak tree in the courtyard. It's really the cypress tree in the courtyard. And so, you know, if you know anything about an oak tree, they're wonderful trees. They're really beautiful. It's one of my favorite trees. I love oak trees, and they're usually like 150 feet tall or 120 feet tall when they're mature. They're beautiful leaves and acorns, wonderful. But this is not an oak tree. This is a cypress. And if you know anything about trees, a cypress tree is an evergreen tree. Okay, so. Home Depot sells sawaya cypresses that people use to line the borders of their property, right? So they make hedges out of those or large walls of trees out of sawaya cypresses. So, you know, when you're working with this koan, you should visualize a big green, a mighty green cypress if you want, but not an oak tree, okay. So actually, that's not too much help, you know. I mean, if you sit on the cushion and you visualize this green tree, that's not a bad start, right? And you can say tree, or you can say cypress tree on your out-breath. Okay, so, you know, as you're saying cypress tree on your out-breath, what you might find is that you can actually see the cypress tree. The cypress tree may feel very real to you, you know, when you're saying that. That's a stage in your engagement with this koan, but it's not really the breakthrough moment in working with the koan. So being able to imagine something, or even to hold an image in your mind, which is a common form of meditation in some Buddhist traditions. This is not really solving the problem that the koan is concerned with. Even if you feel that the koan in your mind is real and that you're actually there with it, it's still not solving the problem that the koan is addressing. So what's the problem that the koan is addressing? You know, some koans have immediate dilemmas that present themselves in a way you can't escape. So if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. That's immediately obvious what the contradiction is there. But in the case of this koan, you know, what's the contradiction? What's the contradiction? It's not immediately obvious, and that makes this koan really hard koan to work through, even though it seems so simple. So, one way to think about this koan might be something like this. You know, when we're growing up, we have moments where the boundary between ourselves and the world doesn't exist or it disappears. You know, So I can remember, you know, as a little kid, you know, walking along one night and looking down at my neighbors. We lived in an apartment complex in Baltimore. And my neighbors, my parents' neighbors, had planted a border along the sidewalk to their apartment with petunias. I don't know if you know what petunias are, but they're kind of a showy little flower. They have these dazzling petals, you know, that they've been bred so that their colors are really screaming colors. And these people had picked petunias that were like red and yellow and blue and scarlet, and they had gone to town on making this border up to their apartment. And I remember suddenly seeing those. You know, I probably walked by them 100 times. You know, they were just flowers to me. You know, and maybe I was going to go out to play. I ran down the street. I walked past those. But for some reason, I was walking down the sidewalk and I suddenly looked at those flowers and it was like, it just blew me away. You know, I was so drawn into the beauty of those flowers. And of course, as a little kid, you know, you don't analyze your experience, but you know, probably I must have felt like this sense of like liberation or elation, you know, just suddenly seeing the flower and suddenly, you know, like your whole mind is purple and yellow, your whole mind. This is not a trivial event, you know, actually. This is like from a Buddhist standpoint, this is like a little glimpse of reality. You know, and I don't remember what I did after that. You know, maybe I went home and just had dinner and watched TV. But even now, like 50 years later, or I don't know, 60 years later, you know, I can still remember that experience. I can remember seeing those flowers. And what happened to me was that, you know, for a moment, the boundary between myself and the flowers disappeared. And this disappearance is really like an encounter with a fundamental reality, but rare, you know, it often happens by accident, right? So, you know, I've had these experiences, we all do, you know, but some of them have involved flowers. I remember when I was living in Falls Church, Virginia, I was working construction when I was in college. And in those days, you know, it was very easy to get a construction job if you were able-bodied. And there was just so much construction going on in the early 70s and the mid 70s that, you know, if you were a college student and you wanted a summer job, you could just present yourself on one of these construction sites and make really good money. You know, they would pay you, at that time, I think I was making, you know, $4 an hour, which was a princely sum. In 1972, you know, and I could make $1,000 during the summer. I could sock away $1,000, and believe it or not, that paid for my tuition for the school year. It's unbelievable. So I had this job working at a construction site in a place called Reston, Virginia, and my friend Larry Sullivan, the guy I went hiking with this summer, he would come and pick me up in his father's car. He borrowed his father's car, and he would pick me up, and we would drive out to this construction site together. And I was waiting for Larry to show up, and I was just killing time, you know, staring at the road. And there were these little blue flowers. You'll see them even now. You'll see them sometimes, especially now. They grow by the roadside. They're actually called chicory flower. They're like a powder blue or Prussian blue flower. They're very, very stalky, very leggy, but there'll be these little blue flowers all over them. And, you know, I've seen those flowers a million times. I'd stood there waiting for Larry to pick me up thinking, you know, we're gonna be late. And, you know, but one day I was just looking down at the flower, and it was that same kind of experience. We all have these experiences, but I remember that experience. It was like I became the flower. And, you know, it registered. You know, I thought, that's odd. You know, I'm looking at this flower, and it was like, I was in college, I was reading the Bhagavad Gita and Buddhist philosophy, right? And I looked at this flower, and it was just like my whole consciousness was flower for a minute. And I just like forgot about myself. And this, as I say, from the Buddhist standpoint, is like an experience of fundamental reality. And then I got in the car, Larry picked me up, and we went to the construction site, and we worked all day tying steel and pulling cement down through footings to these buildings, right? So that they could build this apartment complex. But I didn't forget that. You know, I remember it even now. So you know, we have these moments where the boundary between ourselves and the world disappears, and we experience the world as ourself. And, you know, we might just say, well, that's odd, or we might not think about it as experiencing the world as yourself. But when it happens, it's definitely something that's enjoyable, it's pleasant. And, you know, it's a wonderful experience. And in Buddhism, it's a clue, or it's a glimpse of reality. You know, and people pursue these experiences, but they don't always happen, right? So this summer, I had a chance to go out to the Wind River Range in Wyoming, which is magnificent, really magnificent. I must have gotten COVID on the plane, but you know, anyway, I had a great time. It was worth getting COVID to do it. And I went out with some very seasoned hikers, you know, and it was interesting to see them. One of them is actually not you wouldn't say a professional, but he's an ex-climber. He actually used to climb, you know, he looks at cliffs and said, oh, I've gone up that. But, you know, the interesting thing was how often he was sort of like lecturing us on things, and how he was naming things, and he had kind of like an expert's eye, right? So he would say, you know, I went up that face, this is what we did. When we were in a campsite, he would have some little tips, you know, about, you know, where to put your bedroll and so on. You know, I'm not really sure that he had any of those moments where you just feel at one with things. You feel your oneness with things. You know, he was very into like gear, you know, so lots of people who read Outdoor Magazine are into gear. There's a whole gear section. And he is interested in like light. The new thing in hiking is to make everything super light. So when I started hiking, I think the pack I had was probably 55 pounds or something like that. And the pack I had this time was like 34 pounds or something, much, much lighter. And there's all this ultralight stuff. My own backpack is quite light. And I had a sleeping bag that was like under 2 pounds and things like that. And this guy is like the guru of light hiking, right? And so, you know, when he comes into a campsite, what he's interested in is like, you know, introducing everybody to like the light hiking technology, you know, and he was going through my stuff and saying, you know, this is too heavy. This is too heavy. This is too heavy. You know, you don't have to have this, you know, you can. And I am not criticizing him because he made my hike better. You know, he definitely helped me to think about lightening my pack. But on the other hand, I'm not sure he was really having those experiences. Maybe he was, you know, who knows. But I think what humans do, if they're not careful, is they increase their sense of separation from things instead of decreasing their sense of separation because of the way they experience the world. You know, lots of people go out into the wilderness because they've had these experiences of being blown away, of like fusing. They recognize their underlying connection to things. But that's easy to lose, and you can't necessarily reproduce it on command. So if you know, if you ever have had a chance to go to the Grand Canyon for the first time, you know, you may look at it and it just looks like a picture of the Grand Canyon. It's very hard to have an experience of the Grand Canyon without having this idea of the Grand Canyon get in the way. The first time I went to the Grand Canyon, I hiked down to the water. It was early June, so it was very hot at the bottom, but it wasn't too hot. But what I remember is not the big panorama of the Grand Canyon. What I remember is just hiking down and the steep walls of the canyon. And the first time I went down, there was a guy in the canyon playing a flute. And that music was so unexpected. And I listened to it, it was like Mozart, you know? I'm listening to this music and you're becoming one with everything around me. I didn't expect it to happen. You know, if I went back and I was waiting for the flute again, it, you know, that would be a very artificial experience, right? I could even hire a flute player, but I wouldn't have that experience of openness, see? So we have these moments where we experience our deep connection with things, but very often we don't have those moments. And the question is, why don't we have those moments, right? Why don't we have those moments? You know, once we have that experience, right, of being deeply connected to the world, we know it's real, or I think we know it's real. You feel at home. You feel this sense of connectedness and groundedness and aliveness. You know, but you know, often that's not there, even when we try to have the experience, or especially when we try to have the experience. And so the question is, why is that so hard, you know? And I think part of it is that we create a distance between ourselves and the world all the time. You know, we're doing it all the time, and some of it's unintentional and some of it's somewhat intentional. You know, it's like, you know, my friend, the guy who I went hiking with, Larry and I went hiking with, you know, I would say, and he might disagree with me, you know, he's a nice guy, I'm not criticizing him, but I would say, you know, he has turned, you know, the Wind River Range into something that makes it very distant from him, right? He's looking at it as a technical problem for the climber, or a technical problem for the hiker. And, you know, I think in a way he doesn't really, it's possible to argue, again, I didn't ask him, but I think it's possible that, you know, basically he's making it a lot harder to have those experiences, right? To have those experiences of deep connectedness. And because of the way he's approaching the world, you know, it's funny, you know, when you're out there in the wilderness, you know, you're really vulnerable. And it is important to like plan, right? If you go out without a lighter, you're really in trouble. You know, so it's good to have like an inventory, right? This is, I have my lighter, I have my butane stove and so on, or my compressed gas stove, you know. So you do need to plan, right? But you know, sometimes we want to have so much control over our surroundings, you know, it's like mental control, that we can't have that experience of connectedness, if this is making any sense. And you know, we'll have those experiences, but only by accident, when they sort of like escape our control. That's what I believe is true. So you know, sometimes we just hold on to things too tightly. And when we do that, they become distant from us, right? And I think it's very hard for us to really be connected to the world sometime, because it requires a kind of openness and vulnerability that's difficult, difficult. You know, my feeling is that as we're growing up, we have experiences that cause us to distrust the world, right? It's just a fact. You get your new bicycle and you start riding around the neighborhood and you fall off the bike and you break your arm and it's in a cast for 6 weeks, or you knock yourself out, right, while you're riding. And you wake up on the couch and your mother's putting an ice pack on your head, and it's like, what happened? This wonderful bike now, caused me an injury, caused me some pain, right? I remember my cousin went out hiking with the Boy Scouts, and he lay down on, he didn't know, he's from northern New Jersey. He grew up, in Maplewood, and he didn't know much about being out in the woods, and he camped out on top of poison ivy. And when he got back, he had poison ivy like from head to foot, and very serious, very serious case. And he finally got a lot better by going down the shore, and just the salt water really helped. But he was, it was actually quite serious for a while. And he's not a camper, right? It's like that experience made him fearful. I don't think he ever did that again, right? That was like never going to happen again. And, so I think things happen to us that make us distrustful. And it's not just about the natural world, but of other people, if you, the first time you fall in love, you might just find yourself like head over heels in love. And, that experience is so intoxicating, and then maybe the person you're involved with, rejects you, or falls in love with somebody else. It's hard to know which is more painful, right? Just to be rejected or possibly, having the person you're with, fall in love with somebody else. But either way, it's very hard after an experience like that to trust the emotions and the interactions you might have with that person or any other person again in the same way, right? It's like, you're holding back. And I think this is a very subtle kind of energy that we are constantly maintaining. It's like distancing ourselves from the world, and it becomes like our default position, sort of like subtly distanced from things. And it makes certain kind of like logical sense, right? I mean, after all, we have been hurt, and you can go out into the woods and sleep on poison ivy, or a dog can bite you or something. Those things happen, and when they happen, they undermine our trust, and these add up over time. It adds up over time, and eventually we're maintaining like this protective barrier between ourselves and the world. And then, I think we do feel trapped, right? We do feel trapped by that experience. And we try to get out of it, right? And, sometimes we try to get out of that one way we try to get out of that is by like owning things, right? So if I, if I feel trapped by my surroundings, I can go buy something that's mine, right? It's mine. So, maybe I'll get a new car, let's say. We all need a new car, so I'm not criticizing getting a new car, but maybe we're feeling, we're turning 55, you know, and we're thinking, I need a new car, that would be, you know, and we get something, and that makes us feel like maybe we're getting outside of ourselves a little bit, you know, we're getting outside of, you know, a new sporty new car, driving it down the, you know, Garden State, you know, it feels liberating. But it's not necessarily the same thing as getting outside of ourselves, right? It's like a substitute for that, I would say. And you know, so we get trapped behind this protective barrier, and then we try to get out of it. But the real solution, I think, is to, you know, dissolve the barrier. And nothing else we do is really gonna, because nothing else we do is really gonna solve that problem, right? You know, so this koan is so tough, I think, because people have made such a habit of looking at the world as though it is separate from them, right? That's been really important. And we do that to protect ourselves, but then we become prisoners. We become like prisoners. And then we try to get out in various ways. You know, I think alcohol is a way, certain kinds of drug use are a way. These are all kind of like escaping. But, you know, Zen is about dissolving that wall. And it takes special effort because we are, it's such a deep habit of self-protection. And so we have to work on it little by little. It's like we have to gradually take down that wall. And, you know, it can take a long time before we're able to merge or re-experience our connectedness with things and other people and so on. But that's the one way to think about the goal of Zen, is to have that experience. So, you know, one way to think about what we're doing on the cushion is that we're gradually dismantling those, or gradually unwinding those mental habits of self-protection, right? And you can't feel that connection with the world on command. What you have to do is go into, in Zen we would say, go into Mushin, empty mind. And every time you go deeply into Mushin, you begin to dismantle that wall of separation. It's like you're unwinding those mental habits of self-protection and self-distancing. And last night I talked about the fact that we're, you know, my friend called me and she said, you know, I just don't know what to do because so many things seem to be going wrong right now, you know. And she said, you know, the environment, the political system, her personal situation was deteriorating. And we all feel that way. And when that happens, it becomes harder than ever to take down that wall. But taking down that wall means like unwinding these energies, these defensive energies that we've created over time. And so, you know, when we go deeply into Mushin, deep, deep, deep into Mushin, you know, we're unwinding those energies. You know, practicing Mushin is often described as purifying, right? But what's purifying about it is that you're like deconditioning yourself, right? You're going back to a state that's actually empty and completely open, right? That's the goal of Zen practice. It's like going to this state that's empty and completely open. But there's all this mental habit in the way, right? And not all of it's conscious, right? I mean, Most of it's unconscious. But every time you go into that emptiness, you know, it may feel like nothing is happening, but it's like deeply purifying. It's like unwinding all of these mental habits. And so, you know, unwinding those habits takes time, and it takes a lot of practice, right? It took you a long time to become, you know, separated from the world, and it takes, fortunately, it doesn't take an equal amount of time to undo that, but it does take some time. And so, you know, coming to Sesshin and going through this process of self-emptying is hugely liberating. And even if it feels that nothing is happening, most of the action is unconscious. You know, every time you watch your breath, believe it or not, you're engaging in a very complex interaction with the world. You know, just watching the breath, it's so tough for people just to watch the breath. You know, if I give people the breath perception koan, you know, when they first work with that koan, you know, it's challenging for them because they already have all these barriers. When I was working on the breath perception koan, I kept coming into my teacher and giving him what I thought were like brilliant statements. So I would say, you know, life is death and death is life. Or I would say, I would come in and recite a poem. And, you know, what I was trying to do is get him to like me or get him to admire me. But actually, that's my karma, right? That was my karma. My mental habits were getting in the way. So basically, it took me a long time to just let go of all those habits. You know, actually, I had to reach a point where I thought, you know, Genki Roshi thinks I'm an idiot. He probably thinks I'm a hopeless Zen failure. And actually, that was kind of liberating. It's like, okay, I'm a failure at Zen. And, you know, finally, you know, I was able to just observe the breath. And it probably took me 3 years before I suddenly realized, you know, when I watch the breath, my mind goes blank. You know, that was happening to me all the time, but I wasn't able to be present with that because all of these mental habits were getting in the way. So a lot of Zen practice is just like this, right? You know, there's gross mental habits. And those gross mental habits might include things like wanting to be liked by Genki Roshi and feeling unworthy and feeling like a bad student. But at the same time, you know, at the same time, there's subtle obstacles too, which are much more refined than that, that go back much farther than that in one's life. Sort of like pulling back defensively all the time. So you know, basically, this koan seems like deadly simple. It's like dead simple. Joshu's oak tree. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to China from India? See, and that sounds like a metaphysical question, but it's actually a question about how we experience the world. And Joshu's answer is deadly simple. He says, the cypress tree in the courtyard. And what he's really saying is, you know, Zen is about the way we interact with the world on the most basic, immediate level. And what he's really saying is the way we interact with the world on the most basic, immediate level is often profoundly defensive, fearful, and self-protective, and imprisoning. Right, imprisoning. So this is just so, you know, Joshu is such a great Zen teacher. He's able to get at all of something so fundamental, right? You know, when people think of Buddhism, they might think of reincarnation. They might think of the Dalai Lama, you know, and they might think of, mystical powers and so on. You know, Joshi is bringing us right down to something so elemental. You know, the whole world is our mind. The whole world is our self. And, you know, we know that's true, right? We know that's true on an intuitive level. We have these experiences of deep connectedness. And when we have them, they change us a little bit. You know, they give us a little hope. You know, if you saw Avatar, right? You know, Avatar, I think I saw that movie 5 times. It was such a cool movie, and I'm excited that there's going to be another Avatar movie coming out. You know, and, you know, the Na'vi, the tribe in the movie, you know, they all experience their connectedness. They literally take their ponytails and connect them to the great tree, right? Which is like this symbol of connectedness. But intuitively, we know that we are connected to things. We have these moments of connection. You know, it can be with the natural world. It can be with other people. It can be with flowers on the side of the street. It can be with people we love. You know, we might meet somebody we love 20 times during the day. And it's just like this person, this person, this person. And then suddenly, there's like a connection. It's like, where did that come from? Why can't it be like that all the time? And, you know, and that's a complicated question in itself, but when we do connect, you know, that's reality from the Buddhist standpoint. And that experience of connection can be deepened and deepened and deepened and deepened. But the way to do it is mushi, is actually to undo the barriers, undo the barriers. So that's what we're doing at this session, and really at every session, right? And generally speaking, you know, it works. You know, by about day 3 of session, you know, people begin to feel qualitatively different. You know, the barriers are down. And, you know, that takes a special setting. You know, session is a wonderful system for getting to that place. You know, you're safe, you're protected. We're unwinding these barrier energies. And around, you know, day 3 of session, if you hang in there, you begin to have this deep sense of connectedness to things. You don't have to look for it. Please don't look for it. You know, you meditate all morning and you go outside and you look at flowers and you become the flowers, you become the tree. And this is liberation. This is like a deep experience of liberation. So we're on day 1. We're on day 1, and it's often the case on the first day of session that, you know, our barrier energies are very prominent. Right, you know, very prominent. So you know, it on day 1 of session, it can feel like the task ahead of us is you know, impossible to accomplish. Right, you know, the sense of barrier is very powerful and strong. You know, and yet, you know, something brought you here. You know, something brought you to session. And I hope you listen to that voice that said, come to session, because, you know, intuitively we know that things don't have to be this way. You know, that we can start dismantling the barriers, and then the whole world becomes ourself. The whole world becomes our home. And when that happens, we feel real joy and real well-being. And the world benefits. If everybody could get to that place, it would be a very different world. So day 1 is starting to work through our barriers, and not to be intimidated, not to lose ourselves in thinking too much about what we're trying to do, but just to give yourself over to the process. Joshu's oak tree. A monk asked Joshu, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to China? And Joshu said, the cypress tree in the courtyard. how do you experience the cypress tree in the courtyard? How do you experience the cypress tree in the courtyard? Mumon's comment, if you understand Joshu's answer intimately, there is no Shakya before you, no Maitreya to come. So notice that word intimately is really important. Really crucially important. You know, when we ordinarily experience a world as distanced from ourselves, right? And, you know, every once in a while we experience it as like our deepest secret connection becomes clear to us. It's like intimate. You know, we use that word intimate. You know, it's a special kind of relationship, right? It means that, you know, the boundary between myself and the world is gone. So he says, you know, if you understand Joshu's answer intimately, if you know how to be intimate with the world, right, no barriers, there is no Shakyamuni before you. You know, in other words, don't worry about Shakyamuni and don't worry about Maitreya, the future Buddha. You know, Buddha mind is right here now. Mumon's verse, words cannot express things. Speech does not convey the spirit. Swayed by words, one is lost. Blocked by phrases, one is bewildered. You know, if I say tree, you know, if I think of a tree in my mind, that's a million miles away from the intimate experience of the world around me, which is wordless and conceptless. So basically, we can't use language and ideas to get there. We have to take away language and ideas. We have to unwind our barrier energies, and then that connectedness is always waiting for us. So let's explore that connectedness together.